Good morning, I'm Al Haskell. I'm your board representative for today's service. We welcome you to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. And I hope you've had a week of looking forward to enjoying the cooler weather. I know it's a transition. Let's be positive. We've got a variety of announcements, many of which are printed in your order of service. Today seems to be a competition for announcements. I will go through a number as quickly as I can. If I talk too quickly, find me afterwards, and I'll bring you up to speed. There are still a few slots for the Soulful Aging Workshop. There's information in your order of service, and there is a sign-up sheet in the social hall. The Time, Talent, and Treasures auction was an excellent success for us again this year, bringing in over $6,000. So big kudos out to the team that did that and to all of you. Your generosity is heartwarming, and we really appreciate it. So again, Kevin and Amy, thank you so much for that. Janice Tyler weaves a winding path, and here she comes up. You're not going to be circus.
Yes. Hi, I'm Janice Tyler, and about 3 years ago, my mom died, and I'm lucky because I have a lot of good memories of her and things I like to remember. And sometimes I'm surprised by some of the memories that come to me, especially if I'm in the kitchen. And many of us have people that we love that have died, and sometimes those are really difficult memories or difficult times for us, and we might grieve for years. And sometimes even when we're grieving, we want to celebrate those people. And when we do this, we carry on their spirit and their stories and continue their song. So this Saturday, November 5th, we're going to light up the labyrinth. If any of you even know where our labyrinth is, it's been buried under tall grasses for the summer. But we're going to light it up by candlelight Saturday nights from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can walk through it at any time. If you want to bring any pictures or anything else, we'll have a place to do that. And at the same time, we'll have a potluck and a campfire. So you could bring some special food if there is a favorite food of someone you're remembering, or you could just come and have some hot chocolate by the campfire. So let's see. Dress very warm, and if it's really miserable, we'll be lighting up the sanctuary. So, and have our potluck inside. Just if you would see me or Kristen Sandin, if you have any questions. Kathy?
What time is the potluck starting?
Starting at 6, so everything's kind of, it's very informal. Just whenever you're ready to walk through the labyrinth, you can do that. And there is an announcement in there, too. Also, if you need any help getting yourself or your things from the parking lot into the labyrinth or into the campfire area, we'll have some volunteers that can help you get in there. So see me about that, too. Thanks.
Thanks, Janice. I appreciate you scheduling that that evening, because I'll remind all of you that our first orientation class this year is on that Saturday, the 5th, from 10 to noon. Now, there will be snacks, and it will be a very beneficial time spent for you. But now I guess the nifty thing is you can take a little nap here afterwards and then go take a walk in the labyrinth. Please do remind others about this class. We're looking to have a large class size for this year. Jerry and the Green Sanctuary Committee have a goal, and they've set a goal for all of us, so we're all together on this goal of accrediting our church as a Green Sanctuary. So if you'd like to get involved and join in today at 11:45 in classroom number one, so you can help with the process or at least get more information on what's happening. Let's see. Eric?
Yes.
Hi.
If you're a child, today is a great day for you. I brought cookies. Children are going to gather up here in the choir loft after the service, and we're going to get our children's choir started. We're going to rehearse today, and for a couple weeks, and then on our Thanksgiving service, which is actually before Thanksgiving, the Sunday before, our children's choir is going to perform. So, your child, school age through about 11 or so, we'd love to have you in our children's choir. I hope you will come. All children are invited right after the service over there. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. If you would enjoy greeting people around you, I invite you to do so. Sorry, you're out of time. Janice took too long. Now, if you're visiting us today, we particularly appreciate and welcome you. There's a variety of information I'm sure you've seen in the foyer and on the welcome table. If you'd like more information, either see myself or another of the individuals on the membership committee today. I'll be in the social hall after the service. If you want further information about the church, or if you've gotten to a point where you're considering further the idea of joining, and certainly I can talk to you about that orientation class. If you're visiting with your children, it's our custom for the children to stay in the service until we have the story for all ages. Thereafter, they go into their classrooms. Your child's welcome to remain in the service today or to go to the service, and you can, to stay in the service or go to the classroom. And you're also welcome to go to that classroom if you'd like as well. There's a nursery just out the hallway here. Can't miss it. And lastly, and I guess most favorably, we always enjoy greeting our visitors. If you're visiting us today and you'd like to introduce yourself, this would be a great time to do so.
Had somebody come visit me this morning, and I'm really reluctant to
introduce me.
Well, I'll go ahead and introduce him to you.
Favors on stun, please. All right, I'm sure that you're going to find this morning's service stimulating to the mind, inspiring. There's going to be some heart tug in there. I'm building up pretty good, aren't you? Our speaker today is the Reverend Scott Brinster. Now, Scott's spoken with us and shared with us many times over our history. He is currently working on his doctorate at UW-Madison on the history of how science and religion relate to one another. We have, I think, a deep resource in mind and spirit here, and I hope you'll find it inspiring as he talks today on his topic of grief and loss.
Of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. I'd like to invite you to rise as you're able and join in singing together our opening hymn, number 128 in your gray hymn book, For All That Is Our Life.
For all that is our life, we sing our thanks and praise. For all life is our gift, which we are called to use to build the common good and make our own days glad. We give for work and and its rewards. For hours of rest and love, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for sorrow we must bear, for failures, pain, and loss, for each new thing we learn, for fearful hours that pass, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for all that is our life, we sing our thanks and praise. For all life is a gift, which we are called to use, to build the common good, and make our own days last.
Thank you, Jim. Well, if any of our young folks would like to come up closer, I have a little story time for us. We're going to light our lantern also, and the kids, there's a couple things. Normally, we'd like the children to leave after the story, but we've got some special music today, so if the children want to wait until the special music is done and then follow the lead person with a candle, I'll light the RE candle from our chalice.
Thanks, John. Well, some of you might remember this little guy. This is my friend Fudgy Bear.
Fudgy Bear!
Fudgy Bear. You remember Fudgy Bear? It's been a while since Fudgy Bear has been here. Well, Fudgy Bear lives in the forest with Mama Bear and Papa Bear and Grandpa Bear and his brother and sister, Arabica and Espresso. Well, the weather's getting cold already, isn't it? That's how Fudgy Bear knows that it's time to go back to school. Summer is over, and Fudgy Bear's really excited this year about school because he is finally in the first grade. He is a big bear, yes! He's no longer a little bear, and now he's learning big bear things like science. What he learned in science class is that plants need water and sun. And so he grew a plant of his very own from a bean. But you didn't know that beans could turn into plants. Well, Fudgy Bear grew this beautiful bean plant, and he's very proud of it. So every day, he takes it outside and sets it in the sun and gives it a little bit of water. And if nobody else is around, he even talks to his plant. Well, Fudgy Bear had been taking care of his plant and got so caught up in doing that that he realized that he had lost his pet turtle. Couldn't find his turtle anywhere. And if you've ever lost something that's really valuable to you, you know how sad he was. Well, Grandpa Bear noticed that Fudgy Bear was sad, and so he helped Fudgy Bear look for the turtle. It wasn't under his bed, it wasn't on his bed, it wasn't in his bookshelf, it wasn't by the garden. Fudgy Bear was really upset because the turtle might get really lonely out there all by himself. Well, Fudgy Bear realized that even having Grandpa Bear around to help him look made him feel a little less upset. So he was glad that Grandpa Bear was there. And as they were looking, he realized, it's out by my plant. I left my turtle out there by my bean plant. Grandpa Bear said, well, Fudgy Bear, you know, when you've lived as long as I have, you know that things that are lost usually turn up eventually. Well, when Fudgy Bear went out to get his bean plant at the end of the day, though, you know what he noticed? Its leaves were
brown and shriveling up. It had looked like that a little this morning, but now it looked terrible. Fudgy Bear said, "Grandpa Bear, do you think that my plant is sick?" Grandpa Bear said, "Well, I think that it's fall, and your plant is doing what all plants do in the fall. You see, the leaves are turning red and yellow and brown, and the plants are all dying and going back to the soil, and I bet that that's what your bean plant is doing." Well, of course, that explanation didn't make Fudgy Bear feel any better. He was still very sad. But Grandpa Bear helped him collect the seeds from his bean plant and said, "Next spring, we're going to plant all of these, and you'll have lots of bean plants, and that will be pretty cool." You know, Fudgy Bear, when you've lived as long as I have, you lose a lot of things, and you have a lot of sad memories, but you have happy times, too. Well, that night, Grandpa Bear tucked Fudgy Bear into bed and said, "Are you still sad about your bean plant?" And Fudgy Bear said, "Yeah, I am a little bit. But you know, Grandpa Bear, when you've lived as long as I have, you learn a lot of things. I learned that when you're sad, it's better to have a friend with you to help you feel stronger." And now we're going to have some special music with Karen before you guys go off to your classes.
This spiritual song for many evokes a higher power, but for me, I think of the beauty of all of you and your help and support of me and the world and this community.
When I am down and oh my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened me, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand the mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be.
Karen, for sharing that special music. And now it's time, another special time in our service, for our time for sharing our joys and concerns. And so if you have a special joy or a deep concern you'd like to share, please raise your hand and tell us your name, and I'll light a candle for you. And I'll light our first candle in thinking about all the conflict in the world and searching for a better way.
Like a candle, it's Karen. I'd like a candle for my brother-in-law, John Carrigie, who died this week, and for his three children, and my sister-in-law, Kay.
I'd like you to light a candle for my sister, Margaret. Her cancer has come back. I've mentioned it before. And they're trying another chemo because she's had more lesions in the liver now, too. Thank you.
I'd like you to light a candle of joy for our dear friend Mary Pope. She had bacterial pneumonia. Most of you know that she had moved to Illinois to be near her children. She is recovering. I, and I know many other people, are so relieved.
I'm Chris, and I'd like to light a candle of sadness. Beth, my wife, her stepfather died last week, Saturday, of complications of surgery from pancreatic cancer.
My name is Esther. I think we should light a candle of joy for having many wonderful musicians, but the song that Karen just sang was very touching. Thank you for that.
Hi, my name is Tony. I'd like to light a candle of hope for all who are in our community and actually in the world who are suffering from the economic situation. Who are stressed and, you know, not sleeping, and the whole gamut of things, aside from loss of luxury, just need that somehow things will improve.
Hi, I'm Greg. I light a candle of sorrow for my coworker, whose wife died unexpectedly in her sleep this week. She's got a tough row ahead. Candle of joy, though, my wife started driving. For those that don't know, she's been unable to with her Achilles healing for 3 months. So thanks to everyone for all of your help.
I'm Joanne, candle of concern for my stepmother, who was diagnosed recently with breast cancer, and for a sister-in-law who is having surgery this week for breast cancer.
And I'll light one last candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts today. Now I'd like to invite you into a moment of meditation, reflection, and prayer. A chance for us to be in silence together to create a safe and sacred moment in which all of these joys and concerns are held. Breathing and relaxing, we let go of our distractions and our preoccupations and our expectations. Breathing
and relaxing, we allow ourselves gradually to be fully here now and open ourselves in mind, body, and spirit to the silence that follows. Spirit of life and love, whom we know by many names, we gather with full hearts this morning. We think of loved ones near and far and their struggles, milestones, and celebrations. We think of the larger world as well, and all who work toward a brighter future for everyone. For the gifts that we experience of clarity and courage, for those around us we can lean upon when we need to, and to whom we also offer a shoulder. But most of all, for this moment, to be together in safe and caring community and hold up the things that matter most to us. For all this, this morning we give thanks. Blessed be and amen. Now I invite you to rise as you're able and join in singing together our second hymn, number 89 in your gray hymnal, Come My Way, My Truth, My Life. Husband, United Church of Christ Minister Michael Dowd.
Connie is herself a chemist by trade, and she and Michael travel speaking about the reconciliation and the collaboration between science and religion. So if you know me well, you know that these people are very important to me. And if you've not gotten a chance to hear any of their programming, they love Unitarian Universalists, not surprisingly. I highly recommend their work. Connie's poem is called The Gifts of Death. Without the death of stars, there would be no planets and no life. Without the death of creatures, there would be no evolution. Without the death of elders, there would be no room for children. Without the death of fetal cells, we would all be spheres. Without the death of neurons, wisdom and creativity would not blossom. Without the death of cells in woody plants, there would be no trees. Without the death of forests by ice age advance, there would be no northern lakes. Without the death of mountains, there would be no sand or soil. Without the death of plants and animals, there would be no food. Without the death of old ways of thinking, there would be no room for the new. Without death, there would be no ancestors. Without death, time would not be precious. What, then, are the gifts of death? The gifts of death are Mars and Mercury, Saturn and Earth. The gifts of death are the atoms of stardust within our bodies. The gifts of death are the splendors of shape and form and color. The gifts of death are diversity, the immense journey of life. The gifts of death are woodlands and soils, ponds and lakes. The gifts of death are food, the sustenance of life. The gifts of death are seeing, hearing, feeling deeply. The gifts of death are wisdom, creativity, and the flow of cultural change. The gifts of death are the urgency to act, the desire to fully be and become. The gifts of death are joy and sorrow, laughter and tears. The gifts of death are lives that are fully and exuberantly lived, and then graciously and gratefully given up for now and forevermore. All that we love passes away. Moreover, our awareness of this fact makes it a bittersweet task to give ourselves in love. As the chill of fall is already upon us and all of its evidence of the turning of the year, our minds cannot help but acknowledge that the continued cycle of life is impossible without the constant presence of death and loss. We join together this morning to seek understanding in that dance of joy and grief that marks the experience of human life. The consciousness that humans have evolved, distinguishing us from other creatures, comes at a high price. That we experience painful anxiety, denial, and dread at our anticipation of death. As far as we know, no other organisms foresee the eventuality of their deaths, so we can be reasonably sure that humans are unique in all that we do to create meaning in a life that includes death. Humanity's history reveals our enduring struggle to interpret death so that we might make our peace with its unavoidable presence. Plato advised his students in ancient Greece, "The wise man will not count this life a matter of much concern, so for such a man, death will have no terror." It was in Plato's era that the idea of an afterlife was gaining so much of its influence, inspiring Western culture to value this time and place less than the heavenly reward to follow. The influential work of medieval theologian Thomas Aquinas, firmly based in that Greek worldview, inspired Christianity to adopt the concept of a heavenly plane upon which our earthly suffering would cease to matter. The Western world has thus been powerfully shaped by the idea of a better place awaiting us. The difficulty of this legacy is that it offers us an eternal ideal, but does not guide us in struggling with the messiness of real and mortal lives. Of course, not all worldviews have been as avoidant of death as Christianity's. In the hope of thwarting a prophecy in which the Nepali prince Siddhartha would become either a holy man or a king, his family shielded him from all forms of human frailty, including aging, disease, and death. But every myth and fairy tale warns us that our attempts to control the nature of things will invariably come to ruin. Surrounded by comforts and luxuries, the young prince was inadvertently exposed to the nature of humanity during a carriage ride. Seeing an old woman hobbling slowly down the road, he asked his driver, "What kind of person is that?" The driver responded, "That is old age, Siddhartha, which we all must face." Later on his ride, the prince saw a man begging for alms, his body racked with illness. He asked his driver, "What kind of person is that? Is he too old?" The driver replied, "No, my prince, that is illness, which we all must face." Still later, the carriage passed a funeral procession with a weeping family bearing a body along the road. Again, the prince asked his driver, "What about this person?" The driver explained, "This one has died. Death is also something we all must face." Siddhartha realized that it is in our nature to experience frailty and loss, and that while a life of indulgence may numb our feelings, it will not protect us from these realities. Thus, the prophecy was fulfilled, and he began the spiritual journey of non-attachment that led him to be known as the Buddha. Another story that I'm quite drawn to is a myth from the American Indians about a time when people were given an opportunity to change this human predicament forever. The gods offered them a tempting possibility. Death would be eliminated, but only with the condition that there be no more children born. Either no death and no children, or the life we know today with both death and children. Imagine no more death. No more dreading the end of this life that we know and love, all the time in the world for new encounters and new learning, no more loss of the accumulated wisdom of our years and experiences. But no more children? Never to hear again their laughter or witness their undisguised curiosity or innocence? It was so hard to weigh one against the other. Finally, the grandmothers spoke out. "Of course we will choose to keep both death and children. What would the age of wisdom and maturity mean, after all, if there were no one new to share our stories and insights with? How could life possibly remain precious if we never see it anew through the eyes of our young ones?" And so the grandmothers chose for their people, and we have been blessed ever since with children and challenged with death. The story helps to remind us that death is not only natural, but is actually necessary. The gift of human consciousness has co-evolved with the reality and inevitability of death, and therefore our consciousness and death are inextricably linked. It's here that I want to broaden our conversation to include not only death, but a variety of losses. One of the legacies of scholars like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is that we recognize that our responses to other kinds of loss closely resemble our responses to death. We've come to understand that the world is an engine that runs on change and loss, and these losses make possible literally everything we know. As we heard in Connie Barlow's words earlier, this in fact means, is the means by which all of creation has happened. Without the deaths of the earliest stars and violent supernova, the universe we know would not be possible. Out of the fusion reaction of these cataclysmic explosions were created all of the elements heavier than hydrogen and helium. Without the loss of these first stars, neither rocky planets nor the conditions for life would have developed. Without the extinction of entire species, evolution could not have occurred by natural selection. None of the complexity or diversity we enjoy would have been possible, and the planet would have promptly been overpopulated with its first undying organisms. Without the death of prey, life could never take advantage of the energy stored in food, and we would never have developed energy sources beyond photosynthesis. Without the death of cells, plant life would never have progressed beyond slime molds a few cells thick. The ability to use the rigid remains of previous generations of cells is what allows plant life to soar upward on stems and trunks. Without the death of fetal cells, our bodies could take no form but undifferentiated spheres. The emergence of structures and organs happens through what is called programmed cell death, without which multicelled life would never have been possible. Without the death of brain cells, the connectivity that constitutes intelligence could not be created. An adult human has about half the neurons of a newborn child, but it is through programmed cell death that mature intelligence in the form of memory, creativity, and imagination becomes possible. Without the death of old ways of thinking, there would be no means for new ideas to emerge. In the same way that biological death drives the evolution of life, ideas must rise and fall for the refinement of human wisdom. And on and on and on. By now it should be clear that nothing we know of life would be possible without the cycle of creation and loss that drives the entire cosmos. Of course, none of the earlier life forms that took the path of complexity and sophistication could have known where it would someday lead us. Death and loss are utterly vital to all that is, but they are also deeply painful to us. We recognize from scholars like Kubler-Ross that our grief response is also natural, even necessary. As perverse as it seems, grief, too, is life, vital to life as we know it. How do we make sense of this hard truth that everything we know and love comes at such a cost? How do we make our peace with the paradox that the very beauty and richness that bring us such joy are inextricably linked to the heartbreak we feel in the face of loss? None of our willingness to acknowledge death and loss as vital lessens the sorrow of losing what matters most to us. None of this rational discourse makes loss or grief any more welcome. Like an infant who is suffering the pains of teething, we must feel the pain of our loss, or deny ourselves the very life that we are trying to protect from our grief. Our unfortunate response as a culture has been to try to thwart or prevent grief, which would be like responding to children's teething by removing their emerging teeth entirely. The importance of the grief response is forgotten in our short-term desire to escape pain and avoid suffering. Natural or not, necessary or not, many of us would gladly trade away some of the benefits if it meant being freed from our grief and being spared the awfulness of others' grief. The simple but by no means easy truth is that we cannot be spared. The reality of grief is that it must be endured. At our 1999 General Assembly in Salt Lake City, the Reverend Mark Bellatini, who was my minister when I was in seminary, preached a marvelous sermon at the service of the living tradition. He shared with us a story from when he was a 28-year-old, new to the ministry, working with the congregation in San Francisco. He received a telephone call from Margaret, one of his church members, asking him with some urgency to join her that day for lunch. Margaret had once been an enormously accomplished and influential woman among the Unitarian Universalists in the Bay Area and denominationally, but she had suffered a personal life of tremendous losses. Her first child, a talented artist, had been killed in a car accident. Her second had committed suicide. Her third was arrested and imprisoned for committing several terrible murders. Her fourth grew up in a family broken and haunted by the fates of the other three children, and lived a life marked by rage and deep sadness. Margaret herself had understandably become an eccentric and harsh person through the course of these terrible losses, and often she seemed not to care if she lost or hurt anything or anyone else. On Memorial Day in 1979, Mark met her to go to lunch. Just after they crossed the Golden Gate Bridge, Margaret suddenly said, "Turn off here." They drove over a winding road across a hillside, arriving at a well-hidden cemetery. Margaret said softly, "Stop here." Without waiting for Mark, she climbed out of the car and up the slope to where two gravestones stood, surrounded by orange California poppies. Carved into the stones were the names of her two dead children. Margaret dropped to the grass and lay sobbing with all her might. Catching up to her, Mark stood and waited, unsure of what else he could do for her. After about 15 minutes, which Mark confesses felt like hours to him, Margaret slowly rose and fixed him with tearful, swollen eyes. "You did very well, young man, refusing to console me. You know you can't really do that, and it's to your credit that you didn't try. But I thought it might be important for you to know that this is what happens after your parishioners leave the church, after the lovely funerals you offer, and that this can go on for a long time. Time doesn't heal as fast as they say it does." Then she started down the hill, saying, "Thank you for being kind enough to stand by me in silent witness. Now let's go to lunch." Mark learned what all ministers and those in the helping professions must learn, that no words or advice will remove the pain of grieving, any more than explanations would remove the pain of a teething child. And Margaret's story also throws a challenge at the feet of our attempted reasonableness about death. Not all deaths are timely. No one would be able to say that her children's deaths, one in an auto accident and the other by suicide, could be a part of any reasonable scheme. Our forward-looking culture, driven by the lure of progress and the cult of efficiency, has no patience for the long, long arc of the grief process, and no wisdom to help us weather untimely losses like Margaret's. But our lives are derailed by emotion for the task of remembering, brought to a stop so that we will not fail to acknowledge who has made our lives precious. And even as we willingly stand by the grieving, when their pain is at its most dramatic, the following days and nights of quiet aching and nostalgia continue to challenge a society that demands tidy schedules and quick recoveries. In the helping professions, we speak of the time after a loss or painful change as grief work, and hard work it is. Even if we were fully reconciled to the inevitability of death and loss, it would be hard enough. But we intensify our suffering by trying to exert control over something that is mostly beyond our control. The effort of grief work is what is required to create meaning in a universe in which we live and die, in which all that we love is mortal and will be separated from us. And yet we are not allowed to beg off. We must love nonetheless. Losses, the little ones and the big ones that we experience, are in some ways like that woody tissue that allows grasses and trees to rise up on stems and trunks. The dead cells left behind by previous generations are the raw material for our growth and continued living. What then does this community have to offer its members in times of loss and grief? What will Unitarian Universalism provide us in the way of comfort and guidance when the rug is pulled out from under us? For me, as a theologian, one of the great legacies of this movement is that whatever we might believe about an afterlife, we hold up the importance of valuing this life as a precious gift, not wasting it while we wait for what comes after, and preserving it and living it unflinchingly. I look to the words of poet Mary Oliver, who writes, "When it is over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world in my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world." I believe that grief is praise for what we have lost, and that we make meaning by celebrating and expressing that praise. It's truly a bittersweet task to find among the expressions of our hurt some spark of gratitude and hope. As this congregation grows and changes, I know that you'll have to face again and again many of the same emotions and trials that come after death and other major losses. The constant flow of life means hard changes and offers us the equally hard task of being grateful even as we are grieving. Giving ourselves unabashedly to love and great-heartedness, knowing that what we love will someday be lost to us, but loving nonetheless, is a way that our grief itself can become a meaningful experience. Standing as witnesses to grief work, our own and others, is a way that we stumble forward on that precarious path to a meaningful life in the midst of loss. From the inanimate origins of the web of life to the deepest recesses of our hearts, the cycle of growth and loss is a miracle that threatens to tear our hearts in two with its intensity and inevitability. But in the words of poet Stanley Kunitz, one of my very favorite phrases, "The heart breaks and breaks and lives by breaking. It is necessary to go through dark and deeper dark and not to turn." May we have the courage and the love of life not to turn away from the holy work of this grief work. For truly it is here that lies the source and the sustenance of all that we love about life. May it be so.
Thank you, Scott, for sharing these thoughts with us. I found them quite meaningful, having lost a friend this last month, and it does help, and it makes a lot of sense to me, and I think I'm not alone in thinking that this was very timely that you would speak about this today. So now we do have some time for a polylog, just a little bit of time, and if you've got any insights or reflections that you'd like to share with the rest of the congregation, please raise your hand and be brief so all may share.
Hi, I'm Barb. Thank you so much for your words today, Scott. Grief always surprises us. I lost a very, very dear friend 10 years ago. And my grief is still very much with me. I have felt guilt about it. I felt angry about it. I've accepted it. I've gone through all these stages, but it's still with me. And I think that's, you know, grief gives way to joy. And yet still, I'm still doing the work. Thank you for your
thank
words.
You, Barb. That's the hard part, yeah. We've become accustomed to thinking of things like grief as things like a cold that can be treated and gone away at some point. But that person that meant so much to us is never gone from us. And so, of course, the feelings are never gone from us. I mean, the idea that, you know, that bittersweet combination of love and loss would somehow eventually disappear, to me, would be like forgetting them or losing them entirely. Again, it's like that Indian story that you lose something of even greater value when we anesthetize ourselves to grief. It sounds like you've come to a place of some peace about that, the sense that the feeling is always with you. I'm still working on that part, clearly.
Hi, Scott. It's Chris. The older I get, the more, and I'm sure this is true for a lot of you, we encounter people who have lost people, and I'm always trying to learn how to say something and not ignore it, because I have a friend who lost a child when he was 20 years old. That's been 10 years, and I've learned a lot from her. And other friends who've lost spouses. And just this week, I was encountered a woman that I don't know very well, but she reminded me that it was 2 years ago that her husband died. And I can't ignore it. I have to say something. And I did say something good in that I said to her, oh, I was reminded that the grandchildren came with costumes, Halloween costumes, to visit. And she said, I had totally forgotten that. Thank you for that. So I felt, oh, good. I said something good. And then I think I said something else and felt like I struck out because she kind of marched off and said, I've heard all the cliches.
Oh, yes.
And then I thought, okay, well. But I felt bad about it a couple days ago. So hearing you talk about it is reminding me that I still feel that I feel better having said something than nothing. Because my friends who have lost people, the one thing that they tell me is they don't want that person forgotten. So I feel like, oh, even though I might not have said the right thing, if, you know, they probably aren't even thinking about what I said, but, you know, it's so hard. It's hard. Without being just silent, like you
right.
talked about in that story. So as I get older, as I said, there's more and more people to encounter.
What do you say?
But you have to say something. At least that's how I feel.
Isn't that the hardest question? That is the hardest thing of all, I think. That, you know, with our own grief, we have some sense of what we need and wish other people would do for us. But with other people, it's so easy to project other things onto that. And I think what I hear you pointing at is a really common illusion that we like to tell ourselves, which is a very convenient illusion, that, well, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to remind them of their loss. I guarantee you, there's not a moment when they don't remember their loss. You're not going to remind them that they've lost someone precious to them. It is always with them. And so I think that you're very, very wise in not allowing that person to become disconnected from all of her network of friends and support. I mean, how hard it is to go through life losing someone, but then for that to become a reason to be isolated from all of your living friends and support is just such a cruel irony. I think the role of silence that is useful is worth mentioning, though, because it's not being with someone in silence is not the same as ignoring their grief. I think that Mark's struggle with Margaret on that hillside is one of the things that I remember most vividly from my training as a hospital chaplain, that often, you know, I had nothing but wrong things to say. I had lots of wrong things to say, and I could have pulled out any one of them at any moment. And they were all about my own insecurity with that person's grief, and my own discomfort with that person's rage, and my own wanting to smooth things over and make it nice and make them convenient and comfortable for me. And that, thank goodness, my chaplaincy training taught me was the wrong thing to do. But often just to be with them and symbolize for them that they're not forgotten, they're not left to go blundering through this grief alone, but that even if you have nothing that will change their day or lighten the sting of their grief, that they're not alone in that. And I think that's very wise of you that you saw that, Chris.
And thank you all for sharing. One more.
I already got the mic, so we're not going to keep going.
I had an experience, I'll be quick. This last summer, a very close friend of mine had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And so far, so good. Things turned out well for her. But during the time where it was very much unknown, she doesn't live near me, so we usually talk on Sunday nights, and I have absolutely crappy reception on my cell phone, so I used to have to drive somewhere, you know, at 10:30, 11 at night to be able to talk to my friend. So I'd be sitting in the parking lot somewhere at night on a Sunday night talking to my friend, and for the first couple of conversations that we had, it was the first one that we had in this situation where we talked about her cancer and we talked about what she was going through, and she became quite irritated with me because she felt I wasn't really listening, and I wasn't really listening. I was wanting to smooth over, I was wanting to move past it, and I consider myself pretty able to sound the depths with people when they're feeling terrible, but I was not doing it. And so my dear friend, being my dear friend, got all angry and hissy at me, which is, and she, you know, in some regards had every right to. And at that moment, I started listening, and we dropped down a level in terms of what we talked about and the depth. And I remember thinking to myself driving home from one of those conversations that I will never, ever forget them. Sitting in a summer's night, looking out at the stars up above in the country, talking to my friend about what life means and what facing death means. I'll never forget that.
Oh, that's an amazing story. And I'll just say briefly, I'm going to be here for the coffee hour, and I've gotten the impression that quite a few of you are caring a lot related to loss, and I'm very happy to talk more with you after the service. I think that you raise a really valuable point, though, that often someone who is going through such a time of threatened loss and all of the emotions that are connected with that cannot be mad at who or what they really need or want to be mad at, and she felt that she could trust you to be mad at, and that is pretty amazing and hard to be the recipient of that. So that's amazing that you were able to be here for her in that way. Thank you for a wonderful conversation. Again, I'm happy to talk more with you after the service. This time, our ushers will pass the basket for the giving and receiving of the offering. All that you're able to give to the growth and the work of this congregation does make a difference and is very much appreciated. Thank you. This affirmation is from the Reverend Barbara Peskin, who has recently retired to La Crosse. She writes, "Because of who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery." I invite you to rise as you're able and join in singing together our closing hymn, number 354 in your gray hymnal, "We Laugh, We Cry."
Something here. Thank you. reason.